given that it is Thanksgiving, we have something to be thankful for, which are the blessings of Abraham, the physical blessings and also the spiritual blessings as well through Jesus Christ. And all of that is impossible. It would never have happened the way it did happen without faith. So that's the source of all the thanks, all the things that we could be thankful for. So now it would be a good time, especially as Christians, to ask ourselves the question, how does our faith compare with Abraham, father of the faithful? How does our faith compare with Abraham, father of the faithful? And in that case, how do you define faith anyway? Faith is, it's kind of a religious term that is used in various contexts. How would you define it? There's a lot of definitions out there. There are a lot of smartly concocted definitions with elements of truth to them. One poet said that faith is a passionate intuition. That was William Wordsworth. He was a major English romantic poet who, along with Samuel Coleridge, helped to launch the Romantic Age. One definition says, faith is not contrary to reason. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's some definition that somebody came up with. Faith is not contrary to reason. I don't know if that means anything. That was Sherwood Eddy, an American Protestant missionary and author. He also said that faith is reason grown courageous. Interesting definition. I don't know what that really means exactly. Faith is reason grown courageous. Henry Ward Beecher, he was a prominent clergyman, said that faith is spiritualized imagination. I don't know what that means either. Maybe you can explain to me exactly what that means. Faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase. That was Martin Luther King Jr. Interesting one. Faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase. Not really a total definition, but just an illustration. And here's an interesting one. This is from St. Augustine, who's probably one of the most influential philosophers and theologians. He lived in Rome and Africa Providence, and his writings were extremely influential in the development of Western Christianity, mainstream Christianity as we know it today. He said, faith is to believe what you do not see. That's what he said. The reward of this faith is to see what you believe. So that's what he thought about faith. He said, faith is to believe what you do not see. The reward of this faith is to see what you believe. I don't know if that's accurate or not or means anything necessarily, but that's another definition. So my question for you, is there a place in the scriptures that actually gives us a definition of faith? The answer is yes. If you will, we'll turn to Hebrews 11 verse 1. Hebrews 11 verse 1. So before we talk about how our faith compares with Abraham's, it doesn't hurt to have a definition of faith to go on, because there's a lot of different definitions out there. It'd be nice to start with something that's clean and it's straight from the scriptures, and that's what we have here. Yes, Hebrews 11 verse 1. It says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That's the way it's described. I don't think that, correct me if I'm wrong after this message, after services. I think the wording here is not the way that you and I typically talk about stuff. You and I usually wouldn't say, well, that's the substance of what you would hope for. It's kind of an odd combination of phrases. So it probably doesn't hurt, I suppose, to go into more detail and try to clarify what this is saying. So just using Thayer's lexicon to do this, looking at some of the key words that are here doesn't hurt. When you see this word faith, the Greek word that it's translated to from this is pistis. Pistis, and it means conviction. It's a fixation of belief. It comes from a root word in the Greek that means to bind together, something that binds together. And actually, the Greek root word that pistis comes from was actually used to name the goddess Peitho, which literally means persuasion. And although, of course, it's a culture with a pagan practice. This gives you an idea of what the word is talking about. It's about persuasion. It's about persuasive power. And in the usage here, it's about binding belief to make it very strong and solid. It's a very solid belief, and usually when you see it used, it's relating to trusting God. So it's a very solid belief that comes from trusting someone or something. It's not a religious concept, necessarily. You can have faith in anyone or anything, potentially. You could have a faith in Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, or some combination. You could have faith in anything. Or the book of Obadiah, where Edom, one of its problems is that it has faith in its location. The people of Edom thought that their location was a high place that couldn't be destroyed. And unfortunately, it can be destroyed and gets destroyed. So it's possible to have faith in anyone or anything. And this definition is saying, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So what does this mean, substance? Greek word there is hypostasis. And it simply means an underlying structure that makes something stand up. Just like a foundation. You could say that my house has a hypostasis, which is the foundation. It's an underlying structure that keeps something standing up in place. So that's what it's saying. It's saying the substance of things hoped for. Things hoped for. You may have caught, I said, I hope that nobody's sick. I said hope in a way that is not what is meant here. It's not talking about an empty wish. You know, it's like, I hope so. That's not what it means. It's kind of a modern variation that's come on the scene. Even the word hope originally did not mean that. It primarily is an expectation. It's talking about an expectation of something that's going to happen in the future that has not happened yet. So it's saying faith is really just a strong belief that's based on trusting God. Faith is the substance. It's the foundation of what drives what we expect to happen in the future. That's what it's saying. It's what's driving what we expect to happen in the future is faith. So it's saying faith is what drives our expectations about the future. And it says that it's the evidence of things not seen. Usually these days when we talk about evidence in a court, evidence is not conclusive. It is not proof. It's a piece of information. That's not what this word means from the Greek. It's a stronger meaning than that. It's proof. It's not just evidence. It's proof of things not seen. The Greek word is blepo. It means to see with the eye. It also refers to understanding with the mind as well. So this is talking about it being the proof of things that we can't see with our eyes and we can't even fully comprehend. And as well, we're to study with Abraham, he didn't have either. He couldn't see it with his eyes and he didn't have enough information. There's no way he had enough information indicated by the scriptures to be able to comprehend what was being shown to him about what the promises that he had that God would give to him. That's what the faith is that we're talking about. And just to recap it, faith is just a very strong belief based on trusting God. It drives our expectations about the future, and it is proof to us of things that we are incapable of seeing or comprehending to a certain degree. We may have some understanding, but there's some point where faith is what is the proof to us of something that is beyond us, is what it's talking about. So with that in mind, with that definition in mind, what qualities did Abraham have in his faith? I'm going to just give you seven qualities here. The first one is from a bumper sticker, and I'm kind of ashamed doing this because I hate religious bumper stickers, I'll admit, and I probably shouldn't think that way. If you have a religious bumper sticker, I'm sorry. Just please forgive me. But this is actually from a religious bumper sticker. But in this case, it works out. God said it, I believe it, and that's that. God said it, I believe it, and that's that. That's the first point of a quality of Abraham's faith. Genesis chapter 12. Don't mind, we'll just go to Genesis 12, verse 1. It says, now the Eternal had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. and I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This is an astronomical promise that the Eternal gives to Abram. So think about this for a moment. Abram doesn't have a Bible in any way that we know of. He doesn't have a church, a temple. He has nobody else to talk to except to God himself. And God is telling him to leave his family, leave his comfort and wealth. He's living in Ur of Chaldea. It's a lavish place to live with. It's close to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, especially close to the Euphrates River, where it's a great place to live. And then he's got all of his family around him. Everything's just right from a physical perspective. And here, God isn't even telling him where he's going. He just says, get out of your country. Just leave where you are now to some place that I will show you. I'm not even going to tell you where it is right now. And I'm going to do all these things. You'll become the mechanism through which all of humanity gets blessed or cursed. But what does it say? It says, so Abram departed. It doesn't say, what? It doesn't say anything. It just says, so Abram departed. God said it, I believe it, and that's that. And Abraham is a prototype of our faith. So as Christians, that's what we do. We do that the same way. We're people who just take God at his word. That's the lesson we can get from that. Number two is faith comes by hearing. We'll continue here in Genesis 12. As you read, God spoke. And that means that Abram heard something and then he responded. Faith comes by hearing. That means there has to be a word that's heard or read or received from God for there to be faith to begin with. If a person doesn't receive something from God, then there's no hearing and there's no faith. Faith comes by hearing. Genesis chapter 15. A lot of things have happened. We skipped 14. Lot's captivity and rescue. Jumping to 15 verse 1, it says, after these things, the word of the Eternal came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not be afraid, Abram, I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward. And this is a double promise. It's saying that I'm your shield, I'm protecting you. Read through chapter 14. Abram had already experienced that he was protected by the Eternal. But also it says, your exceedingly great reward. And that's saying that you'll get great blessings out of this from me. So he believed that. At this point, for him to believe what he believed and hear it, he had to think about God in a different way than anyone else around him thought about God. At that time, all the gods, all the pagan gods, were believed to have local territories. In fact, if you read the story of Balak and Balaam, you find Balak trying to get Balaam to curse Israel from different mountaintops. And Balak and Balaam go from mountaintop to mountaintop, trying to curse Israel and make Israel become cursed. And they discover that God's everywhere. He's not missing from one mountaintop or another. He's everywhere. For Abram to believe this, he had to see God differently. He had to hear God for who he was. Number three is that faith builds on previous experience. And this is indicated through Abram's story. Let's go up 1,000 years past this point in time to see a good illustration of this in 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. And verse 33. It says, and Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth and he a man of war from his youth. So Saul wanted to stop David from fighting Goliath. And David said to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock. I went out after it and struck it, and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. I'm never going to let my kids try to rescue a sheep from a predator like a bear or a lion. But apparently, as we can know here, this was actually out of faith in God that David did this. He was not foolhardy. It was something that would give him an experience that would prepare him for the Philistine. So your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Moreover, David said, the Eternal who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and the Eternal be with you. And he goes on to do that. So faith builds on previous experience. Before David encountered the Philistine, he had rescued sheep from predatory animals. That was also out of faith in God. Let's jump to Romans chapter 1, verse 17. Romans 1, verse 17. Says, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. The just shall live by faith. From faith to faith. David went from the faith of rescuing the sheep to killing the Philistine. He went from faith to faith, and at each point, he got stronger and stronger over time. It's like a building block. Every time we encounter a difficulty, a trial, and have to exercise faith, it prepares us for the next trial that will come up. This ties into point four, though. Faith has moments of perplexity. Faith has moments of perplexity. You're in good company if you've ever been perplexed in your faith, because that's exactly the way Abraham was, the father of the faithful. Now, so I'm not talking about a breakdown of faith. I'm talking about an area of perplexity that requires further work to be completed. It happens all the time. Perplexity, questions that aren't answered. Let's go to Genesis chapter 15, verse 7. Ideas that are too big for us. They make us perplexed. It's actually a normal thing to have perplexity in the faith. That's what true faith has. It has perplexity. The question is, how do we respond to it, and what do we do when we have this perplexity? Genesis 15, verse 7, it says, then he said to him, I am the Eternal who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord God, how shall I know that I will inherit it? Wait a minute. He just said that he believed, and it was counted to him for righteousness. And yet he wants to know. In some sense, there's a lot of speculation of why. Maybe he thought the descendants of Abraham wouldn't be worthy and they would sin so much that they couldn't receive the blessing anymore. But in any case, he was perplexed to some degree. His response was, even though he believed, he was perplexed. He said, how is this going to happen? So he has to perform a sacrifice. According to God, he asked for proof even though he believed. There was still a perplexing element that had to be worked out. Let's go to Genesis chapter 16. It says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, see now, the Eternal has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai, this is the father of the faithful. He believed God. It was accounted him for righteousness. But he was still perplexed, and he was not made out of iron in terms of his beliefs. He was somebody who could make a mistake. He could be perplexed and operate on the opposite of what God promised. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. You know, the I can have a baby and you can't type of problem. Then Sarai said to Abram, my wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into you in embrace. And when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Eternal judge between you and me. They're still working with the Eternal, even though They have faith. There's some perplexing quality to it. So what do you and I do? We know here that eventually, 18 verse 11, Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age. Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Sarah laughed. "After I've grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord, being old also?" And the Eternal said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I surely bear a child since I am old?'" Is anything too hard for the Eternal? God specializes in the impossible. "At the appointed time, I will return to you." Appointed time, it's the same word that's used to refer to the holy days, the appointed festivals. God had a precise appointed time, despite all the perplexing experiences that Abram and Sarai were having. God, at this whole time, had an appointed time when Isaac would be born, as he had promised. So, but what do we do when we're perplexed? How do we respond to that situation? Should we follow that? Should we come up with an alternate plan? Let's jump to Psalm 73. Psalm 73. There's actually an answer. This psalm will answer that question. It'll show what to do when we're perplexed. This is a psalm by Asaph. I'm not going to tell you which verse actually gives the answer when I read this. It's like giving the end of the movie. We'll read through this. Psalm 73. It says, "Truly God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart." Right, of course. Of course he is. "But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped." Something is bothering him big time. He's making big mistakes. Something is really weighing heavy on him. "For I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." As it's called in the theodicy, the problem of evil. Why is it that the evil prosper while the good suffer? No good deed goes unpunished, right? That's what this is saying. "For there are no pangs in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men." You know, some of the drug runners, drug traders, you know, they have wardrobes that are worth more than our houses. Therefore, pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than heart could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walks throughout the earth. You know, they're living life like God doesn't really exist. The reality is that the wicked are the ones that prosper. "Therefore, his people return here, and waters of a full cup are drained by them." And they say, "How does God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? Doesn't God know what's happening here? Behold, these are the ungodly who are always at ease. They increase in riches. Surely I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence. All this righteousness stuff has been a big waste of time. Look at what's really out there. For all day long I have been plagued and chastened every morning. If I had said, 'I will speak thus,' behold, I would have been untrue to the generation of your children. I would have sinned against the people of Israel, God's people. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. It's beyond what I can bear thinking about. Then I understood their end. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end." And that's the answer. When we have that perplexity in our faith, we have to go to the sanctuary of God. And then he was able to see the big picture. He was able to see the end result of these wicked people and the good people and the big picture of what God is actually doing. God specializes in the impossible. What seems to be impossible to us, for him, it's just the big picture. And that's all that it's saying here. When those things happen, we have to pray, we have to study, we sometimes need to fast. When we have that perplexity of faith, it's not a sin to have that perplexity of faith. It's part of the process of growing, but we have to respond to it the right way. We have to pray, we have to fast and meditate. And that's what Asaph did here, as it's recorded in Psalm 73. So what happens after these experiences? Number five, faith emerges strengthened. Just like Asaph here, Genesis chapter 21, verse 1 through 8, as we read, God had the fixed time when he gave Sarah Isaac. That time was always set. And so when the trial is over, Our faith emerges strengthened by it, guaranteed. Given that we've exercised that faith, it will emerge strengthened. Sixth point is that we're a spiritual people, and faith sees things through a spiritual lens. The perspective that we'll have through faith is spiritual. And this is indicative of the character of Abraham in Genesis chapter 13. Genesis chapter 13. The correct decision was exactly the opposite of, from a physical perspective, what looked correct. It was exactly the opposite. Lot thought he had it figured out. It says, Abraham went from Egypt, and he and his wife and all that he had and Lot with them to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and in gold, and he went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there at first. There he called on the name of the Eternal. But it comes down to this ish matter of Abram and Lot not being able to get along with each other. They have to separate. For some reason, they just can't get along. Strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Verse 8 says, so Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your brethren. For brethren, is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left. So you can see them looking. Abraham is looking out all this land from a spiritual perspective. He knows which land looks better. It says, Lot lifted his eyes and saw the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Eternal destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Eternal, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zorah. So that's obviously the place to pick. So Lot picks that place. Abraham takes the opposite. He has that, because of his faith in God, he has a spiritual perspective on the situation that would be impossible without that faith. That's how we should look at all of our situations. We have to look at it from the spiritual perspective. And it's in the church, we have opportunities to take a loss. And, you know, maybe we're not willing to take a loss as much as we should, just like Abraham was willing to take a loss. He was willing to go the opposite direction from what was the most reasonable direction to go in, whatever Lot wanted. But as spiritual people, we can see things through a spiritual lens, and ultimately, those decisions that we make will end up being the right decision. Finally, number 7, faith brings an ultimate reward. God gave many promises to Abraham. When you start to count all of them, not even just the promise of physical blessings. If you read Genesis 13, verse 15, it talks about forever. It talks about a blessing on the seed forever. For all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever. But who is the seed? You know, Paul explains in Galatians 3, verse 16, that seed is Jesus Christ. It's one seed, in a sense, is how Paul understands it and explains it, is revealed through Jesus Christ. Abraham will receive eternal life. So let's go to Hebrews 11, verse 8. Hebrews 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. It goes back to that point about our definition of faith. It's based on not being able to see it and not really being able to know or comprehend it to a certain point. By faith, he dwelled in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. He waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. So there was something bigger through faith that he was able to anticipate beyond the physical, something that's spiritual. 11 verse 39, we'll just jump to Hebrews 11 verse 39. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So God gives an ultimate reward to those who keep this faith in him. And those are the 7 qualities of Abraham's faith that can help the church, help us as Christians And they're the source of all the spiritual, physical blessings that we can be thankful for. You know, without faith, there could be no thanksgiving.